I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. Helen Gurley Brown, the woman behind Cosmopolitan magazine, the woman who wrote the 1962 bestseller Sex and the Single Girl, died on Monday. She told the world that unmarried women had sex and that they liked it. She anticipated Carrie Bradshaw and the Sex and the City franchise by almost 40 years, and today we see her sexually liberated women in Mad Men. Here with me to talk about the mark she made on American culture are our pop culture contributors, Tom Connolly and Rachel Rubin. Tom Connolly is a professor of English at Suffolk University. Rachel Rubin is the chair of the Department of American Studies at UMass Boston. Welcome back.
Hello. Hello, Callie.
So the thing that I have to always remind myself of when I heard about Helen Gurley Brown's death, and she was 90 years old, by the way, is that she wrote Sex and the Single Girl in 1962. You know, context is really everything. So when you think back to 1962, it's no wonder that this was just revolutionary, Rachel, in what was being said at the time.
You know, that's absolutely true. And I think it's really important to place things in their historical context. So I'm fascinated right now by, you know, Helen, by her moment and by our moment now, what people are saying about her, which I sort of see as two separate things. Mm. And the thing that I've just been thinking over and over is, you know, sexual liberation, you know, I'm all for it. It's more than just deciding not to be a prude. And so right now, for instance, we can't have female sexual liberation unless we defend access to birth control, which is, you know, under assault right now. So I'm thinking of Loretta Lynn's song, The Pill, you know, describing another sort of step towards sexual liberation.
Tom?
It's interesting to bring up birth control. There's been a lot of praise heaped on her and a lot of, almost hagiographic statements written about her. I've been surprised at the small number of carping or negative comments about her, but the most consistent thread is, if it weren't for the pill, Helen Gurley Brown wouldn't have had her career because without the biological reality of readily accessible birth control, she wouldn't have been able to practically advise women to have the sexual freedom that they did. I, of course, remember the film made of Sex and the Single Girl, which is one of the great travesties of early 60s cinema. It has absolutely nothing to do with the book. I mean, it's a really ridiculous screwball comedy, but it does have something to do with an aspect of her career that is forgotten, and that is that her husband, David Brown, brought her through the last gasp of the Walter Winchell era type of columnist and the sort of upper middle class world of the nightclub and the sort of widespread gossip and the lifestyles of the rich and famous under the radar, if you will. Mm-hmm. She was brought into a world where, you know, wife swapping and ménage à trois and bisexuality was the norm. And she wrote about this idea of approaching sex as something you do rather than something that's part of marriage in a way that's absolutely vulgar in the purest sense of the word. And that's what I think Helen Gurley Brown brought to mainstream journalism. Pure, unabashed vulgarity. And for that, people who went to Smith, like Gloria Steinem, would never forgive her.
Kind of like the print version of HBO, if you will, on at the time. I'm wondering if there are lots of folks who are hearing Helen Gurley Brown's name and it has a great resonance, and those who do not. Which category are you in? 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Was Helen Gurley Brown really a liberator for you? You can tweet us at Boss Public Radio or write to our Facebook page, facebook.com/Boston Public Radio, or call us 877-301-8970. I am here with Tom Connolly and Rachel Rubin, our pop culture contributors, and we're considering Helen Gurley Brown's legacy and impact. Rachel, you were about to say something.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to quickly pick up on something Tom said about people carping about her. A thing that they're also saying a lot about now is how she basically defended sexual harassment in the workplace, most notably during the Clarence Thomas, you know, thing. But overall, she said, you know, that's just like, that should be that way. It's nothing to complain about. You know, so it is interesting. And she also said women should have sex even if they don't feel like it. If they're involved with a man, they should just always do this. So there are these little reminders that sexual liberation, when it's detached from any other kind of, you know, organized thinking about gender, it's really open what it might mean and to whom and who can wield it. The other thing is that I do want us to remember is that there's been a lot of talk about how Cosmopolitan and the magazine she helmed are always doing financially really well, which does redound to her. But it also how do magazines do really well? It's because they sell a lot of advertising, right? So we have to remember that these were platforms for telling women things that they needed that could then be solved by a purchase.
Tom?
It's even worse than condoning a sexual harassment. She actually, I distinctly remember her belittling the entire concept of women complaining about sexual harassment. And this shows, I think, a profound disconnect, which is revealed by her marriage, the way she conducted her marriage, the way she conducted her private life, which was actually quite stayed. You know, she was married for decades to one man, never had any affairs that we know of, and was basically a workaholic. Whereas she told women her magazine said, go out, have affairs, ideally marry for money, ideally find a married man to use for your own purposes. And she also, I can remember her reveling in the supposed sexual harassment that went on in all the offices that she worked at, talking about games that she played with men and allowing herself to be used like that.
And you were both speaking to the contradictions that were so much a part of her life and made 70s feminists really say, what is this woman talking about? But a lot of other women saying, to your point, your earlier point, Tom, that by pushing the envelope, through vulgarity, if you will, then she pushed some other barriers as well for women to be a little bit freer. By the way, she did have premarital affairs. She admitted to those, though she was happily married, by all accounts, to her husband, whom she adored. So let's listen to Helen Gurley Brown, who described herself as a mouse burger, a plain girl. And she's offering trade secrets about getting a man.
How do we unspectacular ones compete? Here are some of the trade secrets. Now, let me tell you a lovely thought you may not have thought of. Why is it flat-chested girls are the sexiest in the world? They have to be, I said. And it's true. If you lack the cleavage that's bound to please, but you crave love and to be courted just as much as the bosomy girl, splash perfume all over you, or better still, drench cotton with it and tuck it in your bra, then I think we concave ones almost will ourselves into a certain surface kind of sexiness, at least.
That just seems so out of place now, Rachel.
But, it really does. It really does. And it's another, it really does. It's fascinating. It really reminds us how things change. And, you know, we do, I'm all for vulgarity. I have to say that, you know. And I do think, I sort of cherish these moments where we see that being vulgar can be a serious political act. It can be. And I think it's also worth reminding ourselves through this, all this, you know, talk swirling around her, that when people say feminism, they don't necessarily mean the same thing.
That's right. And that's very important statement to make. Let's get Martha from Saugus in on this conversation. You are on Boston Public Radio 89.7. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Callie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that growing up, when he started this whole Cosmo empire, I was a freshman in college, and I went to a Catholic university from 12 years of Catholic school, and she was a light shining on us, because back in those days, in the late 50s and the early 60s, polite young ladies did not discuss this thing anywhere with anybody. They didn't discuss sex. You didn't say the word. And as part of women's liberation, she got the conversation going. And I think that we have her to thank for part of that. People, you know, loosening up and starting to talk about things that had been behind closed doors and in closets for so, so many years. And they published a small Zodiac booklet every year. And my friends and I, we ate that up every year.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. We read her magazine.
That's good.
And I also read Ms. Magazine and a bunch of other publications from the feminist movement, and I enjoyed them all.
Give me an example of one of the specifics from the magazine that just, like, you know, blew your mind at the time.
Well, it was articles on what to do in bed. I mean, you know, I had sex education taught by Catholic nuns in high school.
Okay. So this was different.
So I want you to, you know, note the contrast here, you
yeah.
know. And you didn't mention body parts. It was still very Victorian, you know, and it was an eye-opening wonder.
It's really...
It may not have been the greatest journalism in the world, you know, but the attitude that she put forward in that magazine was equally as strong as any you got in any of the other feminist publications. So,
right.
You know...
Rachel Rubin wants to respond
and
to you.
And I think... Yeah. And I think we have to look at feminism as being multifaceted.
Mm.
No, I agree with that, Martha. And I just want to thank you for bringing up something that I think wasn't quite in our conversation yet. And that is the question of class, that different groups of people do have different habits about what they'll talk about and with whom they'll talk about. So, you know, just to like open up that as a sort of more multifarious conversation, I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for the call, Martha.
All righty. Bye.
And we want to hear from others. Did you read Sex and the City? Were you reading the Zodiac publication? Sex and the Single Woman.
Single girl.
As you see, I have Sex and the City on my mind because Sex and the Single Girl was a precursor to Carrie Bradshaw and her ilk. Did you read that? Were you like Martha and had your mind just open to all the possibilities? And did you see Sex and the Single Girl and then later Cosmopolitan and the articles that Tom has described as, you know, pushing the boundaries of vulgarity as part and parcel of a multifaceted feminism, a part of the reading of Ms., a part of just coming of age? Give us a call, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We can be tweeted at Boss Public Radio, or you can write to our Facebook page, facebook.com/Boston Public Radio. Tom.
It's interesting that she mentioned, that Martha mentioned the annual astrology thing. Many people who've been, you know, writing comments in the blogosphere specifically mention waiting all year for that bedside astrologer and, you know, sharing it and women reading it together and looking at it and, you know, taking all kinds of inspiration for that. Which leads to, I think, one of Helen Gurley Brown's real inspirations is her cluing herself into what was going on around her, even though the women she was writing for were of a younger generation. Mm. And her, one of the things that quotation we heard from her directly, you know, putting a cotton ball with cologne in your bra, that's exactly the sort of diction she uses. I couldn't help but think of Coco Chanel's famous remark, you know, in answering the question, where should you put perfume? And her response, wherever you want to be kissed, which is, you know, on walls and, I mean, in framed and, you know, what an elegant woman Coco Chanel is, whereas Helen Gurley Brown is nitty-gritty, you know, put a cotton ball in your bra.
Yeah. Okay.
I also want to throw the Kinsey Report into the conversation because these things were also, you know, coming out right about the same time. I think the Kinsey Report on male sexuality was before Sex and the Single Girl, and the Kinsey Report on female sexuality was maybe a year or so after. But certainly there was a national conversation starting about sex and what people were actually doing and people beginning to admit that it's not all one thing.
So, from a societal standpoint, I mean, we all are familiar with the Victorian era when, you know, women couldn't say anything. So now, presumably, at least you're in the 60s, early 70s, you're in a little bit more space. This was still so shocking, though, as Martha has articulated and others have said, that Helen Gurley Brown was actually saying sex out loud over and over again and encouraging women to say out loud that they wanted it and enjoyed it. I mean, it's hard to just get your mind around the reverberations of that. And I'm wondering why she wasn't actually slapped down more by society. Why was she able to exist and say this at the time?
Well, I think you just answered your own question. It was the time, right? There was other stuff going on that allowed her to make this intervention. As I said, you know, it wasn't the very first thing, but there was stuff to build on and people were starting to, you know, to sort of notice, I think, that, you know, that you like there, that there was this whole sort of central aspect of human life that had been going, at least by some, unspoken.
That's Rachel Rubin. She's my guest. She's the chair of the Department of American Studies, one of our pop culture contributors.
Also, her platform's Cosmopolitan, you know, a Hearst publication, mainstream magazine with already a huge circulation base. So for her to use this platform in the way that she did is a demonstration that it was already in the air, as Rachel said.
Right, exactly.
Kinsey Report, the sensuous man and the sensuous woman weren't too far behind. The egregious David Rubens, you know, everything you always wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask, and so forth. She was in the right place at the right time. The other thing is, of course, his Mr. Hefner.
Exactly.
Playboy had already been around.
Hugh Hefner. Oh.
And
uh-huh.
This brings up one of her most infamous slash infamous ploys, the centerfold of Burt Reynolds, which turned him into a major star and demonstrated that men can be objectified just in the way that women had been objectified for centuries.
As I recall, I think that was one of the most best-selling issues of Cosmopolitan.
Yes.
James from Providence, we want to hear from you. Go ahead, please. You're on Boston Public Radio, 89.7.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I gotta admit, first off, I'm a younger man, and I have never read Sex and the Single Girl, but I have grown up in an environment that I guess you could say has benefited from it.
So as
a younger man, I would have to say I really enjoy the fact and appreciate the fact that the generation before me went through women's sexual liberation, almost so that we didn't have to. I don't know, is that the wrong thing to say? Our predecessors went through it, and now we get to benefit from it. The conversation's there, the conversation's open, and we get to continue it and take it further. And you see that a lot happening today in American politics with what one of your guests brought up about issues of birth control pill, right?
Mm-hmm.
My question, though, is Cosmopolitan. You guys have been talking about that magazine a lot, and sure, it does a lot of great things of opening the conversation for women's sexual liberation, but at the same time, I've actually read quite a few Cosmo articles and magazines, and at the same time, it seems to really force women to be defined by their sexual appearance and sexual behavior.
Mm. Good point.
And so, that's something that in women's studies is often kind of pointed out that cosmopolitan forces women into a particular mold or standard that they have to adhere to. So I would like to hear from your guests about how do we join those two things? How do we take the conversation of female sexual liberation from the past, kind of mold it into what it's become today, and address the issue of restricting women almost into this mold that Cosmo wants them to fit into.
Well, James, thank you very much, and my guests are eager to answer. Thanks so much for the call. Rachel Rubin.
Of course.
I just want to say, I want to thank you very much for making that point, which I think is hugely important. And it was already in the 1960s that women were starting to say, hey, you know what, this idea of sexual liberation has turned out to mean we're expected to be sexually available all the time, you know, or not. If not, then we're an uptight, you know, woman. So thank you very much for that. It is a sort of double-edged sword. And as for, you know, how to sort of get women outside of that, like that mandate that they have to look a certain way and act a certain way, that's the key question there. And the only thing I can say is I think we need lots and lots and lots and lots of different magazines so that there's more representations and more voices out there. And I also really want to, you know, not to be too depressing, but I want to constantly remind ourselves that these glossy magazines are platforms for delivering advertising. Mm. And so let us not forget that that isn't just like a side thing, that actually does shape the content. It shapes the content. Mm. That's what it's for. Now, if people can sort of find things in it that are useful, that are empowering anyway, that's fantastic, right? That's what we do with popular culture. You sort of sift through, try to find something useful, but more media awareness of how those sorts of, how the advertising advertising in particular is affecting the content, I think is key. And starting with a young age, you know, teenagers need to know that going in.
Tom Connolly.
This brings up another contradiction in Helen Gurley Brown's Cosmopolitan. The difference between the headlines for the articles or the title, the teasers on the cover, which are an endless variation on how to please your man or how to have great sex, and the way that she described what the Cosmo Girl was on the cover. And she always made a point of saying, the Cosmo Girl is looking right at you and is strong and confrontational. Well, if you read the titles that are around those, you know, strong, piercing eyes, they're anything but strong and confrontational.
Let's listen to Helen Gurley Brown talking about the making of Cosmo and what she thought about it.
There should be a magazine for women who loved men and loved children but didn't want to live through anybody else. They were going to do something on their own. You didn't want to get your identity from your football-playing brother or your account executive husband or your rock star boyfriend. You wanted to be known for what you did. Well, nobody, for heaven's sake, had ever thought of that before, so it was a wonderful format for a magazine, and it was just the right time. So the original challenge was just to make it work. It was easier then, my darling, than it is now, because there weren't any others. I had six all to myself.
That was Helen Gurley Brown talking about Cosmopolitan magazine. Wondering if you found Cosmopolitan magazine liberating or confining or contradictory. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We are talking with Rachel Rubin and Thomas Connolly, our pop culture contributors, about Helen Gurley Brown. She died this week, and we are looking at her legacy and its impact on society in general, and particularly women's place in society, sexual liberation as proposed by Helen Gurley Brown, and what has happened since then. Helen Gurley Brown, you two, was quoted as saying, one of her most famous quotations, good girls go to heaven, bad girls go everywhere, as a way of saying that a woman could be independent in the way that she defined herself, and that it's okay to accept your sexuality and, in fact, flaunt it in some ways. But to your point, Tom, the articles were very much seemed to be going away from that kind of independence.
Yes.
She herself was a very happily married man, so she wasn't anti-men. She wasn't saying, and she said that many times, I'm not anti-men. I just want to say that I think that women should take back their sexuality and be able to use it as an instrument as they see fit.
Yes, she also advocates this sort of hedonistic lifestyle, and writers who worked with her who seem almost universally to praise her and feel that she was a very supportive editor and welcomed them, but found that if the conversation ever strayed toward anything about poetry or literature or anything vaguely intellectual, she zoned out. That was just not in her ken. And when I read about this, it made me think of Mary McCarthy's novel, The Group, about a collection of Vassar-educated women who went through a lot of sadness and pain through sexuality, through birth control, and how Mary McCarthy herself had a complicated life. But these characters, in contrast to Sex and the Single Girl and the way that Helen Gurley Brown was advocating, demonstrate a life where you don't really look back. You just go forward and have a good time. And that seems to be what Helen Gurley Brown was saying, that, you know, was not reality. It was a fantasy projection, just as much as the so-called Playboy approach to life was a fantasy. That, you know, this having it all albatross that is around Helen Gurley Brown's neck, and maybe a lot of other people too, is also something that, you know, could never really exist. No one, man, woman, child, can have it all.
Here's what's interesting to me. Right now, according to the latest census data, more single people in the United States than married people. So, in a way, this could have been the biggest audience she ever had if she listened. You know, obviously, more than half of that population, single people, single women. And that puts us at a time now where women presumably have all the control that they need, or have much of what they can do to control their own lives, and certainly their own sexuality. It's not a time where you have to ask permission from your husband, for example, about getting an abortion or taking contraception. And by the way, I should note that in her book, Sex and the Single Girl, when it was published, they made her cut out the part about contraception, which is pretty interesting. But Having said all that, one of the most popular shows, my pop culture contributors, right now on the air is a throwback to the 50s and the women characters who are in that series called Mad Men. And I want to give us a chance to listen to Matt Wiener, the creator and executive producer of Mad Men, because he said Helen Gurley Brown was the model for one of his characters.
I love the way Helen Gurley Brown writes. I love the way she talks. I think it's, you know, a lot of it's very strange and conflicted and contradictory. But, you know, then this woman comes in and I was like, what is she going to look like? What are the two of them going to look like walking down the hall together? And then I said, oh, my God, Joan's not Peggy's friend. This is great.
So what? Now, you want to take the ultimate contradiction, Tom.
It's amazing.
You're the big Mad Men.
While I was listening to Helen Gurley Brown's voice, I thought, that's Christine Hendricks as Joan. The cadence, the diction, clearly somebody knew. I mean, Wiener just said it. He put that into the character. Not that she's a Helen Gurley Brown character, but certain characteristics are there. And certainly the way that Joan is conducting her career and her life is takes Sex and the Single Girl as a primer.
So what do we make of the fact that this 1950s throwback series is wildly popular and these women characters wildly popular based on Helen Gurley Brown and who she was back in 1962, really, presumably Rachel Rubin?
Well, part of it, you know, speaks to the statistic you said about single people versus married people. We're at a moment right now in the United States where we're really, really in a focused and concentrated way trying to figure out, hey, what is marriage? How is it defined? Who's it for? You know, who needs it and for what? And so I do think that at moments like that, when people are sort of figuring out how to go forward into the future, we often do look back. And so there are these different moments where, you know, where what being single means is she's talking about that. So naturally, I think people are going to sort of explore what it meant then and what it's going to mean now. It is very contrary. I also think we would be remiss, you know, by the way, if we say that, you know, in all of her sort of seizing your sexuality talk, that, you know, most people say 10% of women would be automatically left out if they aren't sexually attracted to men. Hmm. We're talking about a heterosexual definition of sexuality, you know, almost all the way through.
Well, in fact, she just dismissed, and you all sort of hinted at it a little bit, certain things that were happening that were real, that were not part of this sort of prettier picture of owning sexuality. For example, she did not want to talk about AIDS at all.
She downplayed that.
So we're talking about that. She didn't want to talk about, as we mentioned a little bit, the moral consequences of having affairs with married men. She just said flat out, I think single women should just have as much sex as possible, and you should, by the way, not get a husband until way later. and if you have to be with married men, that's okay.
Every single woman needs a married man to fill in the downtime or something.
Yeah. So that's a little.
It's interesting. The most recent season of Mad Men, I think most of the crises involve women's issues. And Don Draper's wife, who is trying to get her career back, Joan becoming a partner, and Peggy moving on to a career of her own. And it's one of the things the fans have been complaining about, that Don Draper was sort of in the background, as the women in the show, really, their aspirations and their struggles were at the forefront this year.
Well, so we cannot overlook the fact that Helen Gurley Brown was a fantastic business person for the years that she ran Cosmopolitan Magazine U.S. edition, and then when they sort of asked her to step aside and she went to the international edition. And that's what Andrea of Worcester wants to talk about right now. Go ahead, please. Okay, we just lost Andrea. We'll come back to her in just a second as soon as we can get this technical situation situated. But I want to emphasize the fact that Helen Gurley Brown, Hearst this week, just made an amazing sort of statement about her impact on the business side, on the ledger side. All of those articles, vulgar than they may be, titillating though they may be, contradictory though they may be, really she was positioning a magazine, as she said in her own words, I had to sex alter myself, I had to craft a magazine around it. To your point, Rachel, one that would please the advertisers, and the thing just took off. I mean, it was extremely popular for a long time.
It is. It was.
I don't know where it is now, I have to say, you know, but I think it's still out there and doing
it. It is, and a lot of women's magazines are gone.
Yeah. That's right. That's a good point.
And certainly the magazines that were in the old cosmopolitan mode, relying on short stories for women to read at home, those are absolutely, you know, only available in archives.
Yeah. So the kind of money that she made, now here's another contradiction that's going to probably shock a lot of people. Last year, I mean, she gave an enormous gift, actually this year, earlier this year, to both Columbia and Stanford, Columbia's journalism school, Stanford's engineering school. She was such a forward thinker in terms of a business person. This was forward thinking around Cosmopolitan magazine, no matter how you think about it. And what she wants to do is inspire both of these institutions to use their great minds to come together to figure out innovation in journalism. She set up an institute in her husband's name, her name too as well, because it's the Brown Institute. And she's asked for these two institutions to split the money. It's $30 million. And each gets a huge hunk of this. It's the biggest gift that Columbia's journalism school has ever gotten. Then she added $6 million for Columbia to build the highest tech, leading edge, forward-thinking journalism lab, really, is how she described it, for them to pull it all together. That's not what you expect from the woman who headed Cosmopolitan magazine.
Well, except for the having all that cash lying around to give it. And as a Columbia alumna, I have to say they don't need all those millions. You know, I would rather bolster public education. However, I do know obviously the reputation of the Columbia Journalism School, and maybe somebody will make something good out of it.
Well, she said she wants something. She wants the collaboration. She said she wanted the collaboration to be groundbreaking, and really for people, as we have talked about her doing in her own way, push past what we understand to be the boundaries now. That I have to say, as journalism is.
Yeah, combining really, with an engineering school.
Right, and also journalism is really struggling now, trying to figure out where are we in the 21st century. And she has just given a huge boost to some major institutions to think about that. A part of this is also going to be something called magic grants. It may end up being something like the MacArthur, maybe eventually. It's to seed the most innovative and promising ideas for future development conceived of the Brown Fellows. So I just had to get that in because we don't think of her as the business part of this. We're thinking of her more as the social, societal impact, sex.
But it's another great reminder that those two things are always connected.
That's right. So I think that is important. Now, as to whether or not she was the Carrie Bradshaw of her time, or was Carrie Bradshaw an extension, Carrie Bradshaw being the lead character, the symbolic character in Sex and the City, the very popular series, which, by the way, Tom, some call vulgar. To your point.
Yes, indeed.
How do we look at both of these pieces of pop culture, what she created in Cosmopolitan and Sex and the City?
Well, I think that the show Sex and the City is closer to the movie Sex and the Single Girl than the book Sex and the Single Girl, because it's really about Carrie Bradshaw's life. It's only incidentally about her career as a writer. I mean, the show would sometimes begin and end with her at her laptop, you know, typing away over the events of things that happened. But it was very much a personal, individual take on issues. And it showed what Helen Gurley Brown was telling about. And I think that's why the show captured the huge audience that it did, because people wanted to see how this literally played out in the lives of the women who were the characters in the show.
But Rachel, presumably 20th century, 21st century women, you know, pretty liberated, know a little bit about sex already. So why was this show that was really pushing the envelope and it could only have been aired on HBO talking about sex in a way that resonated and had a lot of women saying, this is who we are?
I think it had to do with the fact that the four women talked together, that there aren't that many representations on television or in the movies of women's friendships, which we do get together, you know, and talk about sexual experiences and aspirations and, you know, men or women. So I think it had a lot to do with that sort of relationship part of it. In addition, you know, showing people talking about it together.
Okay. I don't say this flippantly. shoes. The fashion aspect of it is another thing that that is equally important. In my experience, most of the women I knew who talked about Sex and the City, maybe they only said this in front of me because I was a man, but they were as fascinated by the clothes that the women wore and the way that they talked about them and the way that Carrie Bradshaw's obsession with shoes was both funny and, you know, kind of compelling in a way that, to Rachel's point, you don't see that kind of woman issue talked about among women on television or anywhere else practically in the media as it was in the show. So it really was a complete take on what women are concerned about. And again, not to belittle it.
And also to say it's not just like a take on what women are concerned about. It's telling women what they're concerned about.
Yeah, again,
right? And so, yeah, you do sort of see consumption as like a central theme of this with the shoes. So
I was going to ask you about the advertising.
You know, then it creates women's obsession with shoes.
Mm. My guests are Tom Connolly, professor of English at Suffolk University, and Rachel Rubin, chair of the Department of American Studies. They are our pop culture contributors, and we are unpacking the legacy and societal impact of one Helen Gurley Brown, who wrote Sex and the Single Girl back in 1962 when nobody was saying sex and the single girl in the same sentence, who died at 90 years old, and we're discussing her 21st century legacy. So for a lot of women, that name's not going to mean much, and it didn't mean much when it was announced that she died. To be expected, and we still don't...
That didn't mean much?
Not a resonating.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know... I think people, though, are aware of Cosmopolitan, like the title of that magazine, people that people would be aware of. And I think that part maybe resonates. But the other thing is, you know, as vulgar or, you know, like door opening as it might have been, that's the sort of thing that gets obsolete, you know. So it's sort of like what's sexually daring now is entirely different.
But to Tom's point, you know, Cosmopolitan is on the stands. To my knowledge, has not cut back to, you know, half a dozen issues a year. A lot of glossy has gone out of business.
Or, it's international now.
Right. Yeah. So, and the comment from Hearst Corporation that publishes Cosmopolitan magazine is saying that it is read all over the world, including, may I say, Muslim countries, which is... actually pretty surprising.
It is. I mean, I think the interesting thing is I think what it's known for now, not the Zodiac stuff so much as the quizzes, you know.
Oh.
That I think people do like to take those quizzes or, you know, even if they sort of do it in a semi-ironic way. And I know men who like to take those quizzes too.
Am I, am I the right person for this man?
Stuff
like that.
Yeah, I
have taken a few of those quizzes, I must say. And they were actually pretty interesting.
Home or doctor's office?
My doctor's has horrible magazines. She went to work editing this magazine 3 years after after the book was published, and she really didn't have any publishing background. So does that speak to the fact that the greatest innovators come from people who just sort of bring it up out of their own experience?
Well, but she also, David Brown was at Cosmopolitan, but he brought her into
That's
it.
That's her husband,
But I think you've got a point. Her approach was, well, we've got to have a new magazine. What am I interested in? What do I think women are interested in? And that's what made her in the perfect spot to be the innovator, to speak to what she saw going on around her and what she thought should be going around and become an influence.
I wanted to read a couple quotes that I've found from the web for people who were, you know, trying to figure out how they felt about Helen Gurley Brown's legacy. Yeah. So they said the behavior of Helen Gurley Brown pushed and made women think they were victims when the unintended consequences hit them. Now women have turned bitter and mean while men have turned to other men. Thought that was a little harsh.
that's just really messed up.
I just thought that was interesting. And another person said, Gurley Brown is kind of pathetic. On the one hand, she was a young, frustrated, and horny Southern girl who went north to liberate herself. And I don't think she ever really found it or really shucked her Southern girl nature. So he's ascribing being Southern to her somewhat contradictory approach.
I would just have a totally different take on what he said, which is that Southern girl brought that sophistication to the North. She came from Arkansas, you know, a place where people, you know, we tend to sort of be little as unsophisticated. But that little Arkansas girl was telling people in the North how to be sexually liberated.
Can there be another Helen Gurley Brown, some person who is able to capture really a nation's attention and go forward in the way that she did?
Only if the Brown grants create a journalist, publisher, editor with the kind of vision, with some kind of 21st century platform, because today things are so fragmented. I mean, I've been... It's a tribute to how popular it is. 50 Shades of Grey has been floating through my head.
Oh, that's
true. You know, that's an example of something, you know, it's, you know, whether you read it on a Kindle or now in hardcover or, you know, it's supposedly being made into a movie. It's not the same as someone taking Cosmopolitan and completely remaking it and making it the voice of one woman to speak to a generation of women. Mm. A comment that I read, which wanted to take away from Helen Gurley Brown's impact, described her as a snowflake in the blizzard of social destruction the 1960s wrought upon American society. And a lot of the really negative comments about her have come from sort of, you know, people who self-identify as traditional Christian family values, you know, one man, one woman marriage sort of thing, who really are very angry at her legacy and at her personally.
I was just going to say, I think the next one won't look like this. I mean, you know, it probably won't be so top down. You know, the next sort of move that, what you said, Callie, sort of to go forward and be inspirational like that, a lot of that is sort of coming from readers now, as the internet and various other forms of publishing blur the line between reader and writer. So I think that there will be this sort of swell of people producing what they want to produce. Do you know what I mean? Like from the readership.
All right. Well, we've been talking about the late Helen Gurley Brown and how she changed the way people thought about women and how women thought about themselves. And I've been speaking with our pop culture contributors, Tom Connolly, professor of English at Suffolk University, and Rachel Rubin, chair of the Department of American Studies at UMass Boston. Thank you, too.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Now for something completely different, we're going to look at wealth distribution in the United States, a huge issue that we're seeing play out on the campaign trail. Research out of Duke University and Harvard Business School finds that despite the ever-widening class divide, most of us would prefer to live in a country where there was greater economic equality. We'll look at why this research is so important. I'm Callie Crossley. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.